Well, good evening. I'm so glad to see you. And I appreciate you braving the elements and traveling all the way from California to be here tonight. Some have come from a close distance, some have come from a far distance. And usually, not always, but usually the distance you travel says something about how much you value Bible study. And I just appreciate so much you taking the time and effort and the expense of being here. And we're going to have a good time. Wherever two or three are gathered in the name of the Lord, He has promised to come and to be in our midst. And I'd like to invite you to stand for the invocation, and we will begin. Our Father, which art in heaven, thank You for the privilege and the opportunity of being here in Kingsport, Tennessee tonight. And we ask Your special blessings on this meeting, that the Holy Spirit will come and will stir each of our hearts with a deeper appreciation and love for Your precious Word, which shines brighter and is more relevant with each passing day. Thank You for hearing and answering our prayers, for we ask these things in the wonderful name of Jesus. Amen. Be seated. I have a little introduction that I like to do at the beginning of each seminar, just so that everyone is on the same page. And I like to sort of tell you a little bit about what we are and what we do. And then as you listen and as you consider the things you're about to hear, you'll have some context or perspective in which to put them. First thing I want to tell you is that Wake Up America Seminars is a nonprofit organization. If you'll notice the spelling. I want to assure you I am not a prophet. I don't claim to be anything other than a student of the Bible. I don't come to you as an authority or a know-it-all. I come to you as a student sharing the things that I've learned. And that's why I'm delighted to be here, and I hope that you come with the same spirit of wanting to see what you might learn from this and that you might be able to take away from it. Second thing I want to say tonight is that I believe the Bible is the only book in the world that reveals the truth about God. I don't accept any other authority than the Bible. The Bible and the Bible only is the only thing that I will accept as authority. I don't accept the Quran. I don't accept the sacred writings of the Buddhas, you know, or the Mishnahs, or the Talmud, you know, the other sacred writings. Every religious system has its own unique sacred writings. And I accept only the Bible. It's the only book in the world that reveals the truth about God. And as far as I am concerned, the Bible is the only source of true knowledge about God. And that's just a given. I accept that. I've proven it to myself after several years of skepticism and investigation. My mission is very simple. I believe that Jesus Christ will return right on time. I don't believe that Jesus is sitting up in heaven by the door waiting to be told that, you know, go. I believe that God has a plan. And I believe that the execution of this plan has been underway for about 6,000 years. And I believe that at the right time and at the appointed time, Jesus Christ will come. So I believe that God has a time for everything. And I'll be emphasizing and showing you why as the seminar proceeds. I want to say this. Wake Up America Seminars is not sponsored, affiliated, nor associated with any religious body. There's no hidden agenda in this seminar. You will not be asked to join a church, nor to leave your present church. And you will not be asked for a donation. Doesn't get any better than that, does it? There's no hidden agenda. There is nothing that I'm trying to sell you or to take from you. I've come here only to give to you what I may be able to give. That's all. You will be asked to consider several things that will be contrary to what you presently believe. I say that because any time you have more than two Christians together, one believes something the other doesn't. Why do you think there are 211 denominations in North America tonight? Why? Because Christians just don't have a hard time seeing things together. It's a difficult thing. And I might add, Christians aren't alone in this. You know, the Muslims have 18 different sects and many subsects. The Jews have many different sects within Israel and Judaism. And in fact, all religious systems are divided in many different ways. I want to ask you to please be patient with me. It takes a few hours to define and to integrate a number of prophetic concepts into one harmonious whole. I can't do it in 20 minutes. It's too big. And so I will say things that are contrary to what you presently believe, and you're going to say, oh, I don't believe that. Forget this. But I'm asking you, wait a minute. Wait just a minute. Wait until you consider the big picture. And then you can, when you throw it out the baby, throw out the tub with it, you know. So be patient with me and give me a chance to lay out what I'm trying to say. And then if you don't like it and reject it, that's fine. That's fair. I want to say a few things about additive nature of learning, the additive nature of learning. You have to know how to add 1 plus 2 before you can do your times tables. Everyone understands that. And then before you can work a simple algebraic problem, you need to know how to do multiplication and division. So that's why we have first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade. And in math, you progress from one platform to the next, to the next, to the next. And it's that way in music or anything, isn't it? And so there's an additive nature to learning. And there's a lot of pieces in the prophetic puzzle. And some of them are very basic, and some of them are very complicated at first. And people will talk about things that are very complicated, not realizing they're complicated. Or they haven't done their homework and established the essentials. So what I'm trying to say to you is that don't bring any friends Saturday when we have our seminar meeting. They've missed Thursday and Friday. So they're going to walk in, we're talking algebra, and they won't have a clue as to what we're talking about. You understand what I'm saying? If you do bring them, it's your responsibility to catch them up. That's on your shoulders, not mine, because I don't want to go back. I don't want to go back Saturday morning when we're studying and find ourselves having to go back to the basics. Okay? Incidentally, we're going to meet tonight, you know, and then we're going to meet tomorrow night at 7, and then on Saturday we're going to meet from 10 till 12 and from 2 to 4, and then on Sunday morning we're going to meet from 10 o'clock to 12 o'clock. And Sunday morning I'm going to take all kinds of questions and all kinds of issues. So that's the plan, that's the general schedule. Consider this for a moment. You know what a paradigm is? A paradigm is the way that you see everything there is. It's your view on love. It's your view on God. It's your view on life. It's your view on marriage. It's your view on children. It's your view on religion. It's your view on discipline. It's your view on right and wrong. Paradigms are like policies that we live by. And we all have paradigms. You can't. Every living person that just has them. And, for example, my dad, for many, many years, would not consider buying a Ford automobile. He was a Chevrolet man. That was his paradigm. And anybody that drove a Ford, piece of junk. Well, he had a conversion. He had a paradigm shift. And now all he drives are Fords. But I'm driving Chevys. It's interesting how paradigms work. They really sometimes have no basis in logic. They just exist. The reason I'm telling you this is because everyone who approaches the study of the Bible does so with certain paradigms. If you were raised Catholic, you're going to read the Bible through Catholic lenses. If you were raised Church of Christ or Baptist or Methodist or Pentecostal or whatever, you're going to read the Bible through those lenses. You're going to sort of approach the Bible from that paradigm which you either inherited or acquired. Somehow you got it. It's just nature. It's just natural. It happens to all of us. Every person who opens the Bible to study does so with some baggage. And that baggage is called a paradigm. It's spelled paradigm, but it's pronounced paradigm. Now, a paradigm shift is when you change your mind. And it is very, 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 very difficult in religious matters to have a paradigm shift. In fact, here's the statistic that proves what I'm saying. Less than 5% of the world's population migrate from one religious system to another. There's 7 billion people on our planet. And less than 5% of the 7 billion people on our planet migrate from one religious system to another. Now, when I say system, I'm not talking about Protestants going to the churches, to the churches closest to the corner. Protestants will move around between churches without much worry. But they're still Protestants, see? But when I'm talking about a paradigm shift, what's the likelihood of a Muslim becoming a Jew? Less than 5%? What's the likelihood of a Christian becoming a Muslim? Less than 5%. What's the likelihood of a Jew becoming a Muslim? Zero. Why? Paradigm. It's the paradigm. And God knows that this is one divided planet that we live on. He knows there's 7 billion people, and He knows there's thousands of different religious groups, and He knows there's denominations and church systems, and He knows the big mess we're all in. The Bible says He even numbers the hairs on our head. That's zero for some of us. But God is not, He is not frustrated by our diversity. And in fact, the story that I'm going to tell you capitalizes on man's diversity to reveal the generosity of God's love. Because the plan of salvation, as I'm going to explain it to you through prophecy this weekend, is the most mind-boggling expression of love that you have ever heard in your life. And I assure you, once you understand what God is going to do, how He's going to do it, and how He's going to save the maximum number of people, you're going to be in awe of the love of God. That's my prayer. That's my hope. That I can articulate this well enough to help you see and understand what a God of love He really is. Most people think of the book of Revelation as a book of beasts and torment and torture and horrible things. And yes, there's some of that in there, but every good drama has, that 10-minute to the hour crisis. On television, when you watch that clock at 12 minutes till the hour, that's when the crisis really gets going, and it gets resolved in the last 3 minutes. Well, there's some drama in Revelation, yes. But most people miss the story because, in fact, the title of the book is The Revelation of Jesus Christ. We call it just the Revelation, or Revelation for short, but the actual title of the book is The Revelation of Jesus Christ and how He becomes revealed as the Savior of the world to every person living on earth, all 7 billion of us, all diverse as we are, all confused as we are, is a compelling story that has no equal. I have found nothing on earth like it. And after you understand it, you'll never be the same either. Those of you who've heard the story a time or two, you know what I'm saying is true. It changes you to realize what a marvelous God He really is. We have a website called wakeup.org. And wakeup is hyphenated. Yeah, I hope that you will go there. I have seminars that have been videotaped and put on the web for streaming video. And you can watch a complete series on Ezekiel or Daniel or Revelation. Or there's hundreds of hours of video. And then there's several books that I've written that are there, all for free. You can read them and download them and print them out. So please visit our website. Everything there is free, and you can study and find things, I hope, that will be helpful in your Christian search. One last gentle reminder, if you have a cell phone, please turn it off. Because there's a Bible text for people who have cell phones that go off in meetings. It's Matthew 13:42. They will throw them into the fiery furnace where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now, some people use Bible texts out of context just that wildly, but I hope you get the point. All right, the big picture. I want to give you the big picture tonight. And that way, if you don't like it, you don't have to wade through 6 hours of this to decide you don't like it. I like to put it up front, lay it on the table, let you see what it is. And if you're interested and want to come back and study for more, great. I'm delighted that you would come back. On the other hand, I'm not trying to sell you anything. I'm not trying to sneak something over on you, and so I'm going to drag you along and pull you through the ditch, you know, to get you there. I want to just give you a big picture and ask you to consider something. First of all, I want you to look at this terrible, rather basic drawing. When you talk to people about apocalyptic prophecy, there's 10,000 different views. You know what I mean? There's a lot of people, millions of people, who believe in a pre-tribulation rapture. You know that. There's perhaps a few million that believe in a mid-tribulation rapture. And then there's a few million that believe in a post-tribulation rapture. And Christians are just very diverse in what they believe and what they think. Well, when I became a Christian, incidentally, today, February 1st, 2007, is sort of an anniversary for me. It was on this very day, 37 years ago, that I got on an airplane to leave Vietnam. I was one happy camper. 37 years ago today. And a couple of years after getting back from Vietnam, I found the Lord and became a Christian, a born-again Christian. And I fell in love with the Bible. It became my greatest joy to study the Bible. And as I studied the Bible, I wanted to understand what I was reading. And over time, the prophecies caused me a great deal of consternation. Because everybody that I went to ask, what does this mean, what does this mean? I kept getting different answers from different people, depending on who you would talk to. And I soon discovered, after talking to maybe 40, 50 people, the Baptists are going to give you a Baptist paradigm. Church of Christ is going to give you a Church of Christ paradigm. Jehovah's Witnesses are going to give you a Jehovah's Witness paradigm. Adventists are going to give you an Adventist paradigm. And so I discovered that everybody has an interpretation that is based on their church position. Well, and the end result of that line of thinking is that there's only one true church, and if you're not in it, you're going to miss heaven. And I just couldn't see that. I don't know. I just couldn't see that God, with 7 billion people on earth and billions who've lived and died in ancient times past, how could they miss heaven because they weren't in the right church and never had a chance to know? And then it began to dawn on me, who has the greater guilt? The Christians who don't go out and carry the gospel, or the pagans who didn't have an opportunity but die without any knowledge of Christ. You know, I really wrestled with all of that sort of thing in my mind after reading and studying and pursuing this question for 15 years. I found something that changed everything for me, and that's why I'm here tonight. I made a discovery, and I think this discovery is as important as the cure for cancer, if should be created. I think this discovery is the most amazing thing in the whole world. And in 1988, the Lord called me to give up my job. You know, the truth will set you free, if your job, your friends, and your church. The Lord called me to go tell the world what I had discovered. I discovered in the process of investigating prophecy that God has an architecture that He follows, and it doesn't matter what church you belong to, it doesn't matter where you come from or what language or nationality you are. It has nothing to do with humanity. It has everything to do with God's design. And here's what I discovered. I discovered that God has, in the books of Daniel and Revelation, He has put 17 prophecies. And here you see I have prophecy 1. And this little yellow triangle means prophecy 1 has a starting point in time. And this other yellow triangle down here means there's an ending point in time. And the events in this prophecy occur in the order that they're given. For example, think about Daniel 2 for a minute. Here's the image, the metal man, and here's the head of gold and the chest of silver and the thighs of brass and the legs of iron, and then the feet of iron and clay, and then the toes, and then the days of the toes. Then the rock comes out of the sky and hits the image at its feet and blows the image all away. So Daniel 2 is an example of what I'm describing. There's a beginning point in time, there's an ending point in time, and the events occur in their order. Not very profound, but extremely important. You see, some things are numbered in the prophecies. 1, 2, 3, 4, like 7 seals, 7 trumpets, 7 bowls. Some things aren't numbered. And so it became, the puzzle for me was, well, how do you know where it belongs on the timeline if it's not numbered? How do you know? The green line here represents time. This is day, months, years, centuries, and millennia. Time going by. And Daniel 2 is a prophecy that has started 2,600 years ago, and it is still, the clock in Daniel 2 is still ticking. We haven't gotten to this point yet. So the clock is just ticking off the days, the months, the years, the centuries, and the millennia. Then I looked at Daniel 7. Daniel 7 is a prophecy just, you know, in its own right. Remember the 4 beasts that come up out of the sea? And Daniel 7 has elements in it that cover portions of the same time as Daniel 2. And these round circles, which don't show up so well in the darker colors, the round circles are what I call linking elements. Think of them as nails. If you took 4 pieces of wood and you stacked them up just like this, and you took a hammer and drove a nail through here, and you drove a nail through here, and you drove a nail through there, you would have all 4 pieces of wood nailed down in such a way they couldn't move. Am I right? Yes. They could not slide with respect to each other. They would be nailed down. And so what I discovered is that God has put in every prophecy something, at least 1 or 2, sometimes 3, elements that will link to another prophecy, and that way we can nail down the timing so that nothing can be moved. Now, think about this for a moment. These blue elements are not what these aren't the linking elements. They're in this particular case, the way I've drawn this, these three must occur between here and there. In other words, what I'm trying to explain to you is that there's an architecture. And once you understand the architecture for yourself, you don't need Larry Wilson to tell you what prophecy means. You can understand it for yourself. You can lay it out and you can decipher it and you can see it and there you are. It's really neat. So this is the basic discovery. And it's so simple, I wondered, why didn't anyone else ever see this? Here's the profound result. Let me show you something. I assume that most of you here have looked at Bible prophecy to some degree or another. So if I'm talking about things you don't understand, I'll try to answer those questions at another time. But just for the benefit of understanding the chronological order of what I'm saying, I want to show you what I've done. If you can turn your head sideways for just a moment, you'll see Revelation 12, verses 7 through 12. This verse is talking about a war in heaven. I believe the Bible clearly teaches that this war in heaven happened on Resurrection Sunday. Satan was cast out of heaven. He lost his place as the representative of earth. And that's why Jesus, when he was coming out of the tomb, he told Mary Magdalene, "Don't slow me down. I've got to get to heaven and take care of business." And when you look at the context within what was said there in Revelation 12, verse 7 and through 12, you'll find that when the angel says, "Now have come the salvation, for the accuser of our brothers has been cast out." We have a starting point in this prophecy. Here's a starting point in time. Here's an ending point in time. And the events, Revelation 12, 7 through 12, then verses 13 through 16, talks about the dragon chasing the woman to the wilderness for 1260 years. And then in 12:17, the dragon is angry because he could not destroy the woman. So the earth helps the woman, and then the dragon is preparing to make war upon the remnant, and the 42 months in Revelation 13:5 is where the war is going to occur. And then during this war, the lamb-like beast, or the second beast in Revelation 13, is going to appear. And then after the devil is physically here upon the earth and the 144,000 are slain, they're going to be resurrected and taken to heaven right before the second coming. Now, I've just said a mouthful here. And I'm sure this is something that you've never heard before. Probably disagree with. That's okay. But I'm trying to show you something that has changed my whole way of thinking. God has put everything in order. And if you don't like the order, If you want to change the order, then everyone else has the same liberty to do the same. And so if God is not requiring us to follow the order of the prophecy so that things are in as He put them, then what authority are you going to use to determine the order of things? Let me say this a different way. Most people who interpret prophecy, here's the way they do it. They'll go get this over here, stick it there, get this over here and put it there, and then they'll take this over here and they'll stick it there, and then they create this great big concept or construct That is purely logical to them. Makes perfect sense to them. But you know something? Now listen carefully. If they didn't tell you what they had done and how they did it, you could never arrive at the same conclusion. True or false? See, if you violate the order of things, and everyone has the same liberty of violating the order, then no one can ever know the order. Right? When God put them in order, they have to happen in that order. That forces us into rethinking what we believe. It did for me. The end result of all this, let me show you what this produces in the end. Let me enlarge this a little bit here. Let me try make it just a little larger. I'll jump down here. Okay. Let me explain I'm not asking you to believe what I'm saying is truth. I'm just asking you to consider what I'm presenting. And let me check the focus on that to get that as sharp. Okay. I believe that we're living right here today in this little space between the third and the fourth seal. And the next thing to happen is going to be the outbreak of the judgments of God. God is going to send four judgments, first four trumpets of Revelation 8. And these judgments are going to cause mankind to react. And the reaction of mankind is going to produce what is known generally as the Great Tribulation. And during this time period of God's judgments, God's going to have 144,000 people proclaiming His truth. And all who love His truth, no matter what religion they are, they will rejoice to see that Jesus is coming and that He's offering salvation to any who will accept Him by faith. Now, that's just a general statement, general overview. If you've read my little book, Warning, Revelation is About to be Fulfilled, you know that I explain the first four trumpets as judgments from God. You know, about 25 years ago, Billy Graham made the statement, if God doesn't send judgments on America soon, He's going to owe Sodom and Gomorrah an apology. You remember hearing him say that? Well, it's not just America that has become decadent. The whole world is decadent. You can look at Iraq. I mean, wherever you want to go, it's just decadence everywhere we turn. God's wrath against decadence is coming. And in His wrath, God is going to send judgments upon the earth. And the first four trumpets are these judgments. The first trumpet will be a meteoric showers of burning hail, and it's going to burn up a third of the earth. The second trumpet is going to be a great asteroid impact, and it's going to hit the sea, and thousands of coastal cities are going to be washed away by the tsunami. So the Pacific Ocean is the largest ocean. Let's say it's the largest target. And you can say goodbye San Francisco, goodbye Los Angeles, goodbye San Diego, goodbye Hawaii, goodbye Japan. When you begin to look at the whole Pacific Rim, asteroid a mile or two in diameter could do more damage than we can calculate. The third trumpet is a great asteroid impact that's going to hit a landmass. And as a result of the ground waves, the geological strata will be broken up, and all the buried waste that we've put in the ground will leach into the aquifers, and people will drink the water and die. And then the fourth trumpet is a great series of volcanic eruptions that will blow the ejecta and debris into the sky and turn the whole world dark. The middle third of the earth, where most of the population lives. This ejecta and debris gets caught up in the jet stream and blows around the planet and shuts out the sunlight. You know, my office manager, Shelley, she and her husband lived close by Mount St. Helens when it blew back in 1980 or 81, something like that. And it was totally dark in the middle of the day because of the volcanic ash that was suspended in the atmosphere. The point here is that God has predicted in the book of Revelation, He's going to send a series of judgments, and they're called trumpets because trumpets are used to awaken people to what God has to say, what God has to do. If you remember in the Old Testament, right before the Day of Atonement, every year, on the 10th Day of Atonement, 10th day, 7th month, on the first day of the 7th month, the trumpets began sounding. They had the Feast of Trumpets, they called it. And the trumpets blew throughout all of Israel. Now, Israel is stretched, you know, about 200 miles from north to south, about 50 miles wide. The nation of Israel is about 50 wide, 200 tall. And so when the Feast of Trumpets was observed, the Levites, who were scattered all through the land of Israel, would get their trumpets and they would go out and blow their horns. And the sound of the horn would go day after day after day. They would blow that horn. And what was the point of that? The point was simple. Get ready, Israel, to meet thy God. Get ready, get ready, get ready. You see, here's how it happened. Well, what happened? Because on the Day of Atonement, this is when Israel had to be found spotless before God. And if someone in the camp had not confessed their sins and had not taken care and made restitution for their wrongdoing, if someone had not taken care of their need to be at one with God, God pointed them out when the high priest went into the most holy place. He said, you know, that Larry Wilson guy? He has unconfessed and unforgiven sins. You take care of him. And God required anyone who was caught in this condition to be thrown outside the camp, excommunicated, shut off, cut off of no inheritance from Israel. They just would die in the wilderness. The whole idea is that the trumpets were designed to awaken Israel to meet God, to prepare to meet and be right with God. The seven trumpets of Revelation have the same effect, same purpose, same parallel. So he's got a world that's 25,000 miles in diameter. He's got 7 billion people, all confused. Everyone having a different religion. Everyone having a different religious system. Everyone having a different religious belief. Everyone speaking a different language. So he's got a really confused world. But guess what's going to happen when the world wakes up one day and discovers that 25%, that'll be 1 out of 4. If the population here is 1.7 billion, then 1.75 billion people are going to die in these judgments, which happen in a period of 30 to 60 days. Then guess what the whole world is going to say, no matter what religion there might be. Everyone's going to say, oh, there's an angry God. The Jews will say, oh, there's an angry Jehovah. The Muslims will say, there's an angry Allah. The Catholics and Protestants will say, you know, there's an angry God. I mean, everyone will recognize very quickly, because of the extent of these judgments, that there is an angry God. And Revelation's story unfolds as men unite together for the purpose of appeasing one angry God. See, they don't know the Bible. They don't know what's coming. They will think more judgments are coming, and they're going to say, we don't get together, if we don't unite as one man, we don't appease God so that His anger will stop, He's going to kill us all. He's going to destroy us all. And this is how there will be sinless laws. Sinless laws, you know, laws outlawing sexual immorality, outlawing dishonesty, laws demanding worship. That's how all of these laws that come into Revelation, where worship is such a big deal, this is the context in which they develop and occur. In a crisis where everyone is scared to death of God. See, there's no fear of God right now. People use His name in vain every day without even thinking about it. I shudder when I hear people say certain things. They don't have any idea who they're talking about. But this is all going to change on the day that God rises up to let His authority be known. This is what the architecture of Bible prophecy produces. No matter what you believe, or how, you know, well, I didn't believe this when I started, but when I discovered the architecture, 1,000 questions evaporated. All the pieces snapped together. And it takes a while to see it, but once you see it, there's nothing else. Am I right? Okay, it's time for an intermission. Let's take about a 15-minute break or 10-minute break, and then there's some refreshment drink at the back of the room, and then we'll resume, okay? Let's do that now.